This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. I'm Poonam Verma. And I chatted to a paediatric specialist, Dr. Mohammed from the Gagash Hospital. And we talked about issues with kids. All kinds of questions came in. We also talked to two female filmmakers, Maitha Alawadi and also Sophia DeMay, who gave us some tips on how to get into the film industry. And if you're into holistic therapy, I had a great chat with Dr. Javed Hingora on homeopath. And finally, master brain. How do you get your kids to be a master when it comes to hybrid studying? We find out more.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Okay, well now we are talking children. Dr. Mohammed is joining us now. I'm already getting texts in. Dr. Mohammed Al-Matboli is a specialist paediatrician at Gagash Hospital. He can talk about anything and everything about your child's health and is knowledgeable in growth and development diseases, feeding difficulties, newborn problems, asthma issues. So send your questions his way. He's here with me now and we're going to have a chat. Hello, Dr. Mohammed. How are you?
Hi, fine. Thank you. How's everything?
Very good. You know, I could never be a paediatrician because if I see children in pain, it just hurts my heart. You must have a strong heart.
Not really. You know, we have got softer heart than you ever expect. But, you know, the problem that there should be someone to treat the pain of children.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, some people, we think that we are bad people because, you know what? We are happy when the baby just delivered. He cries, so we are happy. But that means he's fine. That's during delivery. After that, you know, we understand the language of babies. You know, the babies, they cannot talk. But we, from just facial expression, we can understand what they want to say.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll come back to that, actually, because my sister taught sign language for children called Tiny Talk, and it was an amazing thing that she did before the kids could talk. We understood what they wanted. But I'm already getting texts for you right now, so I'm going to bring up one caller. We have Fatima joining us. Hi, Fatima.
Hi, good afternoon.
So what question do you have for Dr. Mohammed today?
Yeah, so I have an 8-year-old daughter, and for almost a year now, it's like she sweats a lot, and then she has like odor from the underarms whenever she sweats, even after showering.
Okay.
Like when she runs, like 1 minute, you can smell the odor from the underarms.
Okay.
I took her to the hospital. The doctor said it's normal, nothing to worry about. Her brother, who is older, I don't have that problem, so I'm still a bit concerned that could it be something. But I currently use alum powder, and sometimes it helps. So I don't know if doctor has any help home remedy to help with that.
So Dr. Mohammed, her 8-year-old daughter seems to be developing some odor in her underarms. Any advice on that?
Of course. See, odor comes from bacteria. It's not a natural thing. People think that's natural, that's an old-fashioned. We found out that 3 or 4 times of bacteria causing this odor. And we, if she comes to the clinic and we have some examination, and sometimes we can get some swab from the skin. And we found out the type of bacteria is causing that, and we can treat it. The deodorants and the deodorant creams, even nowadays, it's working for some days and that stuff. They're all, working pretty much the same, but, you know, they're not specific. We actually, it's a treatable disease. It's not normal anymore. A lot of things that's been, people think that it's okay. We can just mask it with perfumes and all deodorant and that stuff. No, I think we can treat the whole thing permanently.
Okay, so Fatima, you could probably go and see Dr. Mohammed. Did you understand what he just said?
Yeah, I heard what he said, but I'm in Abu Dhabi, so do I see the pediatrician or is there any specific doctor I should see?
Dr. Mohammed,
you can go to your pediatrician and tell him to try to find out, or even dermatologist, and try to find out what type of bacteria causing this odor.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Fatima.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. Sure. Okay, so also, there's a lot of moms who've been posting on social media, posting about foot and mouth disease. What exactly is that? And are kids more susceptible to that?
Okay, hand, foot, mouth syndrome. It's a syndrome mix of, as from the name, you can find that it's hand, foot, and mouth. It's it's not only foot and mouth. It's hand, foot, and mouth. Mm. And that's a viral illness, comes from a virus, called Coxsackie, eh? And that's it's transmitted through by contact. And much less through droplet, but mainly from contact, skin to skin, I mean. And, from the hand, you will find that some vesicles and redness only at the palm and at the sole.
Yeah.
That's why it's hand and foot. And in the mouth, same thing. You'll find painful vesicles and ulcers in the mouth. Actually, it's a contagious disease. It persists for it's self-limiting, actually. Even without any medication, it will go by itself. But we need just symptomatic treatment, Panadol or gel in the mouth just to decrease pain.
Mm-hmm.
And it persists for 10 to 12 days maximum. And it usually I like to isolate such a patient just not to infect others.
Yeah.
But it's nothing to worry about except just being contagious. That's all.
And
of course, there are some. I'll be a little bit worried about if you have any pregnant ladies in the house.
How long does something like that last, foot and mouth disease with kids?
And then I said 10 to 12 days.
10 to 12 days. Oh, that's quite a long time, though, no? For the poor kids, if you're isolating them. Okay, so questions have been coming up about the Delta variant, and does it affect kids? Have you seen any cases yourself?
No, not so. You're talking about the Delta variant, which is from COVID, or which one?
Yes, from COVID.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, yes. Actually, unfortunately, we started seeing such cases.
Oh, you have?
And I had a 3-month-old baby.
Oh, dear.
And, So that's why I'm honestly, advising people just to take care. I know we cannot just keep the baby wearing mask, but we need to restrict. I don't say 100% restrict not to go out. I don't want the babies to get boring, the family to get boring, but actually, nowadays, a lot of things that we don't really understand. And we need to be very cautious nowadays, especially in going to malls and, places where we have an overcrowd and that stuff. We need to be very careful.
So what kind of symptoms has this 3-month baby had by having this?
Actually, I'll tell you something. The new variants, the new strains from the COVID, they've got two specific things. First, they affect the lung.
Mm.
And they affect young children. That's why recently we start seeing, before we used to see COVID cases positive, but either asymptomatic or some sore throat or even sometimes abdominal pain and diarrhea.
Mm.
But recently we start seeing more lung productive cough and lung infiltration, and even just X-ray will show the infiltration very obvious. That's why the criteria of the new generations, including the Delta one, that it penetrates the spread very fast. It affects the young generation till the newborn. And last thing, it affects the lung very badly.
So
that's why.
If we are supposed to isolate if we are contracted with COVID, does that mean the parents cannot be near the 3-month-old right now? Because it is still contractable from a child.
Yeah, actually, the case that we have actually, because we got the baby to, the baby was isolated in the hospital, but the baby the virus was transmitted to the maid and even to one of our nurses.
But, oh dear. So how do we protect such small babies? Like you said, they can't wear masks. What can we do to help them?
Just make sure that they will not be kissed or carried or anything by others nowadays.
Yeah.
I know that everybody likes to play the gorgeous new baby, but believe me, please avoid that. Strictly avoid it. Just keep them away from anybody, because nobody knows you. Because you know what? When you have somebody who's asymptomatic, you cannot just tell that he's positive or negative, because either he's carrier, either he already he's vaccinated, but he's carrying the virus, or sometimes he is still in incubation period and symptoms did not appear yet.
Do you see us in the near future getting out of the woods with this COVID? Because I mean, is there light at the end of the tunnel? Well, what's your opinion?
God knows. Well, we cannot know because, you know, every time I was expecting that everything is going better. Yeah, they actually is doing very, very good job in that, in trying to control the COVID. But, you know, we are facing two parallel problems. First problem is the new strains that, you know, changing the mutation that's happening for the gene of the virus itself. And now there's another problem that's the side, I call it the sideway. Now we start involving fungus. In the, you know, on top of a virus?
Yes, I've heard of this, yes.
Yeah, so now, you know, sometimes things, if we cannot control it, it will be out of control. That's why I cannot say what will happen in the future, but at least for time being, we need to be very careful. We are
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So, Dr. Mohammed, I've just had another text. It's from a lady called Renee. Now, she says, "Hi there, my son occasionally gets nosebleeds since he was young. Seems to happen in repeated occurrences when he does get it. This is irrespective of the weather. He's not allergic to anything that I know of. Is there something I can do to prevent or reduce this?"
Okay. In such cases, we do the following. Actually, we need just to, if you already exclude the trauma or any other problems in the nose, we need just to do two tests or three tests called PT, PTT, and INR. All of them, we call them coagulopathy or coagulation profile.
Mm-hmm.
Once that's normal, that means we don't have any problem with the bleeding. So just one problem left, which is, you know, the capillaries, which is small blood vessels in the nasal mucosa. It's just weak, and it happens for many children. Nothing to worry about. All what you need to do, if we excluded any blood problem with the normal PT, PTT, and INR, we go to the ENT physician, and they cauterize it. In 3-4 minutes,
they
call the blood vessels, and the problem will end.
Okay, that's great. So there's a subject we're talking about now. I want to ask you about is autism. I have a personal story about that too. I also have a question from Jumana. Let's see what she has to say.
My daughter had COVID, and I did the antibody test, and it shows no immunity, zero whatsoever. It was 5 months ago. Is that normal? Can we do antibody test for kids?
Okay, so she's asking about antibody tests for kids.
Actually, no, we don't do. How old is them? How old is he?
I don't remember.
She didn't know. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Usually, you don't do antibodies for kids at all.
You don't.
Okay. And no, we don't do that. We just, you know, if they're above 8, you know, recently we can give them even the vaccine above 8 years old. And and we don't give we don't check the antibodies at all.
Okay, so I have a question. Somebody has asked, how does one detect autism at an early age? What would you say to that?
Actually, to be honest, in the autism, it's more to be in the pediatric psychology, not the general pediatric. Just to be honest, I'd like to be frank. But, you know, usually we before, you know, if I receive the baby or the family start complaining of that, the baby, that my son start being just, he likes to be alone and not to talk to anyone, and he's not responding to me and that stuff. I just try to talk to him. In my clinic, and just spend like half an hour trying to talk to him and just engage him in some activities. And if he did not respond to me, I cannot just conclude that he has autism. At that time, I need to refer him to pediatric psychologist. They've got their own tools, and that which is really very sophisticated things to reach the diagnosis, because it's not an easy diagnosis. It's not simple diagnosis to reach because sometimes some children are just shy.
Yeah.
Some they don't like just to interfere or to engage with others just for some reason. Sometimes that's their type of personality. It's not necessarily that it's autism. So it's really the diagnosis done by a pediatric psychologist, not by a pediatrician.
Yeah, because one of my friends is very passionate about this, and it's a bit of a controversial topic because we grew up together and she had a child, and I don't know the exact vaccine name, but it's a vaccine that the child
has. MMR.
Absolutely.
MMR.
And I think there's a 10-day gap between them, yes, or something like that?
Yes.
She said to me that when he had the first one, For the next several days, she noticed bruises and she noticed something had changed. And she told the doctor, and they said, no, it'll be fine. He had the second one and he's now autistic. Now, I know there's a big controversy here. Some say it's due to the vaccine, some say it's not. What are your thoughts on that? Because she really believes something came from that vaccine that affected him.
I'll tell you something. The controversy comes from that, you know, where the controversy comes from? When you start doing research, and just gathering all the cases that has autism then, and just link them to the vaccine. When you don't find like 50% or 40% of cases who received this vaccine got autism, so there is something wrong. The point that we need to check the vaccine, which is not proven at all, as far as I know, we need to check the manufacturing of the vaccine itself, because MMR is not manufactured by one company. Because, you know, the vaccine is not just vaccine. There are a lot of additives, and the way that they're manufactured, it's not the same.
So you're saying sometimes each of these vaccines have different components in them?
Yes, yes. That's why I'm saying you cannot just say it's because of the vaccine itself, because I'm sure it's not proven. I read many articles on that. They did not prove it because many of the MMR vaccines, they did not lead to that. So sometimes it's related to the way of the additive or the way they manufactured it.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting.
And sometimes, by the way, it's just coincidence.
Yeah, we don't know how we're going to react. I mean, look at people reacting to COVID, vaccines. Some have nothing. Some are ill for a day or two. So it's an
individual. And recently, I received one patient. One parents. They totally became against vaccination because of this. And this is an extreme, you know. We should not just avoid or stop vaccination just because of a small percentage they got and autism, and just assuming that this is the cause.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Well, it's Poonam Verma with you till 5pm and all this week from 2 to 5pm while filling in for Helen while she takes a little bit of a break. And we're talking to Dr. Mohammed, who's a specialist paediatrician, and we're talking about those lovely human beings we call children, and he is a specialist when it comes to kids. Now, Dr. Mohammed, at what age, somebody's asking, should children start going to the dentist and how often?
Okay, dentation or just teeth eruption starts by 7 months.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, then we continue with the non-permanent teeth. They're like 7 years. And then after that, we start moving to the permanent. Starting from 7 years or 6 or 7 years, we should have a regular visits to pediatric dentist, not general dentist.
Oh, that's interesting.
They're totally different thing, because, you know, the same thing we are saying, that child is not a tiny adult. They're totally different issues. That, you know, different physiology, everything is different. Even when we treat children, when we calculate the dose, even everything's totally different. And even, you know, that's why the adult, they cannot treat children, and we cannot treat adults. So they should be seen by pediatric dentist starting from 6 years, I guess, and they should have a regular visits, just to avoid having problems in the future. Because, you know, I've cut a couple of patients recently. They love drinking juice and strawberry milk and that stuff, and they start having the stained teeth with the black lines at the back.
The stains.
And they never expected that this is really very bad. They just expect because they cannot see it, and somebody realized by coincidence, and that at that time, just after being 12 or 13 years, they start visiting the dentist.
Okay.
Okay. I think from the age of 7, they should have a regular, at least 6 months. Every 6 months, they should be seen by pediatric dentist.
Okay, parents. So from the age of 7, then start sending your kids to the dentist, but a pediatrician dentist, not a normal dentist.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly, yes.
So Jim has text. He says, my young son breathes very heavily when he sleeps. He's only one. Should he be worried, or is this normal? Now, when I brought up my nephew and niece from when they were babies too, I've been around them all my life. I used to find children generally are so relaxed. They breathe quite heavily when they're sleeping. Is that quite normal?
No.
Oh.
It's not normal. Yeah, it's not normal at all. I tell you what, just think about biologically. Now, and if I'm getting my inhalation and just getting out the carbon dioxide comfortably, that means I don't have any problem. If I'm taking that heavily, that means I have a block somewhere in the airway.
Okay.
And children, usually either the mucosa of the nose is congested, and that blocks, because you know the entrance of the nose, the nasal passage, it's narrow. It's not that wide. It's not like the mouth. So if there is congestion in the nasal mucosa, you'll have a block. But the most common cause is the adenoid, which is the gland which is in the upper part of the nose from inside. That usually it's enlarged with the repeated viral illness, and that's the main cause of block of the nose. And by the way, the children usually that obligatory nose breathing, you know, they prefer to get inhalation through the nose, not through the mouth.
Yeah, and you know,
so that's why.
Okay, sorry.
When it's blocked, they start getting the alternative way, which is the mouth. But they should be seen by a pediatrician, and if he needs a second opinion from the ENT, ear, nose, and throat specialist, I think that's the right way.
Yeah, and it's funny, bless them, because when they do have a cold or something, when they're little, they don't even know how to blow their nose, and you just feel like, oh, they can't breathe. It's poor,
exactly.
poor little
yeah.
things.
Yeah. And now we should actually treat this, and we have a lot of medicine for that. It's not normal at all, as I said.
Okay, thank you. That's good for Jim to know. So somebody has just said, my kids had small wounds after swimming in a hotel pool. From my research, they look like folliculitis
all dried up. Folliculitis.
Folliculitis.
Yeah.
It's all dried up now. Should I be worried? It's in the head.
You know, such a question I cannot say unless I see the
lesion.
You
see it.
Because he's assuming that it's folliculitis, but it's possible to be something else.
Yeah.
So I need to see it. No, I cannot answer such a question without seeing the lesion itself. Because,
okay.
We've got like, I can recall now 10 or 12 lesions that I don't know, you know, people are there just searching or Googling things and they think this is what they saw.
Google's dangerous for things
Sometimes they're very similar. You cannot just say which lesion, it's the same one that I saw on Google.
Yeah, no, be careful with Google. I mean, we've all got issues if we go into Google. It's scary, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, please. You need to be seen by a pediatrician. Or in such case, they can just go to a dermatologist as well.
Okay. So Simone has said, are allergies in children hereditary?
Of course, yes. 100%, I agree with that. Some of them are not, just because, you know, like anything could be like anything, which all the hereditary problems could be hereditary or could be something called mutation. Something happened for the first time for one of your children, then after that, it starts being hereditary for his offspring. So, yes, allergies, especially allergic rhinitis, many of the people who are suffering from a nasal block during spring, it happened for the children. Most of them, you know, asthma is some sort of allergy, allergic reaction in the airway, and that's hereditary as well. You know, 20% when you have when there is one parent affected, and 60% of the children will become asthmatic or have allergic rhinitis or even eczema.
Oh, wow.
When both parents are suffering from the same problem.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought sometimes these things can develop independently, whether your parents have them or not.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. This is the 20%, which is called mutation.
Yeah.
That's something new. Yeah.
Okay.
But mainly, of course. And there are different type of allergy, and the hereditary percent of each type is different than others.
So another text has come through from Ciara. She says, my two-year-old son isn't walking yet. He's trying to, but he keeps falling, and I'm worried he's behind other kids. Is there a certain age they should be walking by?
No, sometimes the walking can just be delayed a little bit. If she's there, I can ask her that she is talking or not. By the way, children who are talking fast, they just delay in walking.
I've heard and this. Vice versa. I've heard this. Why is that?
Nobody knows. Nobody knows. That's
well, I talk a lot. I talk a lot, and I'm walking less and less these days. So I think I can see it as I get older too.
Yeah, but you know, first of all, again, that's an diagnosis of exclusion. We need first to rule out calcium, calcium problems, some vitamin E. And please, I need to this opportunity to remind people, please, the most important two wings that we depend on now for immunity. First, vitamin D, and second wing is the zinc.
Okay.
I don't really recommend to test the zinc because, you know, one piece of walnut is enough to give you whatever zinc you need. But vitamin D, please don't give your children vitamin D empirically like that. We need to check the vitamin D level. It's very, very important. Because, you know, it depends on how low is the vitamin D, we calculate how much you need and for how long. And if the vitamin D is normal or we treated you and I mean the children and they became normal, at that time we need to stop any chemical and just get the vitamin D from natural sources, which is under the skin that is activated by ultraviolet rays in the sun. So we expose your children to sun at 10 a.m., 4 p.m., twice a week, half an hour every time, and that will be enough.
And why do you say 10 a.m. and 4 p.m.?
Because ultraviolet, the ultraviolet ray at that time, it's weak, but very effective. But at 12 and 1 p.m., the ultraviolet are very strong and harmful at the same time.
Okay.
And it's very irritant to skin.
Okay. So we have the next question from Ganesh. What's a good cream for ringworm? My daughter is 6 and had one on her right arm for weeks.
Okay. You know, usually we give Vermox, what we call it's a tablet. But again, ringworms are not only one type, and the difference in medication depends on the type. So we need, at this one, we need to be examined and find out exactly what type of ringworm is there. Okay, and they give the medicine. But usually, in general, they get the Vermox.
Okay, Vermox.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Well, I'm learning a lot today from specialist pediatrician Dr. Mohammed. I've just found out if your kid talks a lot, he probably walks less. And if he walks a lot, he probably talks less, which is amazing. So, Dr. Mohammed.
No, just a little correction. If he talks first, not a lot.
Oh, if he talks first, then he walks less.
Yes. Walking will be a little bit delayed.
Delayed, okay. And then if he walks...
And if he is walking first, like in some, you know, some children are walking from 9 months and 10 months old.
Yeah.
Speaking will be a little bit delayed.
Maybe it's just because they're focusing on one thing at a time, right? Either the talk...
Possible.
Okay. Now, Olga says, my child is 3 and has been coughing for about 2 weeks now. We're scheduled to go on holiday soon. I feel silly moving our flight until this cough ends, but I am aware that other passengers on the plane might feel uncomfortable. Now, she's too young to wear a mask. Should I wait until the cough goes away? But her child will need to take a PCT test, anyway, so we can only leave if we're all negative. What's your advice on that? Is jumping. As soon as someone coughs, everyone is nervous, right? That's just the situation we're in.
Yes. Of course, yes. But, you know, just good that you opened this talk because I want to advise everybody, please don't jump for cough syrup because cough syrup is not advisable at all.
Why not?
At all for children. I tell you why. Because, you know, when the airway that, you know, divides after that at the chest area to two, and each airway will go to one lung. When something wrong happens in the upper airway, for instance, virus or dust or whatever goes in, abnormal. You know, that is giving us two reflexes. First one is the sputum that attracts any abnormal foreign body goes inside. Then after that, the second defense mechanism is the cough that gets rid of the dirty sputum. Okay, when you stop that, actually that's totally wrong because the sputum will end up in going downwards to the lung.
Okay.
Instead of that, we always advise to give normal saline nebulizer. Or recently, we've got very good medicine. Even now in asthma, we don't treat with the traditional way of and cortisone and that stuff. And there's another natural substance called betadine or ectoin.
Mm.
It's a nebulizer form as well. And that will block the inflammatory site and will moisturize the sputum. And at that, you know, at that stage, after every nebulizer, the child will start coughing more. And even that, even I advise for adults, they will cough more for 1 or 2 days. When they clean all the airway, a cough will stop.
Oh, okay.
So I'm treating the cause. I'm not treating the symptom. I'm not treating the cough. I'm treating the cause of the cough, so it will not come back.
Okay, amazing. Okay, so Hibbert has just texted. She says, my son is 6, and just last year, she noticed one of his feet is in like a pigeon-toed style. I'm not quite sure what she means. Oh, the way a pigeon's toe is. She said it's not severe, but he plays football and does activities normally. Now, should she worry about this? Is it to do with him playing or the way it's growing?
Yes, of course. No, we need to, if both feet, first, I don't know if one of them only or
one,
or both.
Just one.
But one, no, we need to see it, of course. But we need to see that. We need to do x-ray and just examine him and make sure that the skeleton, the bone are normal.
Okay, so it could be the way it's growing.
Yes, but usually the way it's growing, there will be in both feet. If one foot only, we need to examine.
Oh, okay. So, Hibbert, it's best to get it examined, Dr. Mohammed is saying, especially if it's one foot. Okay. Muncie, she says, my two-year vomits every time she's upset. If we don't pay her enough attention, we refuse to give her something she wants. How can I stop this from happening to her?
Okay, that's a very common question. And my answer is, please, you need to understand that your son or your daughter, they're very, very smart, very, very smart, starting from being 6 months old. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they know how to manage their parents or how to control them. Okay. And exactly, you know, when you start, you give it, if you want to give your son, for instance, a fish and he doesn't want, then you accept that he doesn't want and you said, okay, later, he won the game. Okay, and he knew how to control you. And usually, the girls, they know how to control their father by crying, and the son how to control his mother by vomiting sometimes. Okay, and you know that this is the way that the family will do whatever they want. The only solution for this is just to ignore it. Okay, Don't give him the attention that he wants.
Yeah, no, I've heard this and I find it really hard. So I was in a situation once with my little niece. I think she must have been 3. And my brother and his wife were there and my niece started crying. So the first thing I wanted to do was hug her. And they said, no, don't, because she does this all the time when she doesn't want to do something. And I said, you're really bad parents, let
no,
her.
No. They're right. By the way, I'll just tell you my experience. I did that with my daughter.
Yeah.
And she was 3. And she doesn't like to eat fish. Then I just give her a plate of fish, okay? And I told her that's the only thing you can have in life.
Oh, my goodness.
Nothing else. Okay? Then you know what? She did start crying, and she didn't eat for 2 days.
Oy.
And she started vomiting, okay? And I told everyone, my wife and my kids, please, don't even say, okay, please eat. Baba will get angry. Just don't talk to her, okay? Let her whatever she wants. Even if she didn't eat for 2 or 3 days, nothing to worry about. Don't worry. She will eat. Okay, now believe me, my daughter, she's 16, and I cannot stop her from eating fish.
Wow, that's amazing. I just
don't worry, just don't give them the attention that they want. That's it.
Do you know what? I would never do that because my nephews and my nieces and kids, I always give them attention. I think it's how I've grown up, but my parents never ignored me. Maybe they should have. I would have been a better kid by now, I think.
No, you are very good.
No, I'm learning so much here today, I have to say. Okay, so let's do one more final one. Oh, my God, we've had so many texts. Oh, I like this one. I've been told by some of my friends that kissing my toddler on the lips is not good. It's gross, and it can pass on bacteria or viruses that I have onto him. What do you think? Now, I think it's a culture thing. The way I grow up, we don't kiss kids on the lips. Is it a culture thing?
Yeah.
Or tell me.
It is culture thing, but I know I will say one piece of information, and sometimes it's not nice to say it, but I'm sorry, people, they need to understand it. You know, a number of amount of bacteria which is present in the mouth is triple the amount which is present in the anus.
Oh,
in the gut.
My goodness.
Okay. Oh, that's the fact. Okay. That's why even when you blow at a cup of hot cup of tea, you are just spreading an infection in that cup of tea. Okay, by the way. So bacteria, the mouth is just, it's an entrance. So all the bacteria that you can imagine this life are present. Yeah, they're not harmful because the immunity can control it. Okay, but the number of bacteria are there. And children, they're very sensitive. So when you kiss them in the mouth, you are just giving them a good amount of bacteria unnecessarily.
So, why? So your advice is, parents, do not kiss your children on the mouth.
Of course, of course, of course, of course. And just, you know, if I know if you have a good, another question or otherwise, I need to give everybody one advice.
Yeah, please do.
Okay, please, I advise everybody to avoid three types of medications, please. And that's my final thing I want to tell you. I want to end up. First, as I said, please try to avoid cough syrup. Second thing, please try to avoid antibiotics unnecessarily. 90% of upper throat infection is viral, not bacterial. So please don't jump, you know, and go to the pharmacy and please give me antibiotic because my son has tonsillitis or have a throat infection. Please, 90% of infections will go by itself. No need for antibiotics. Last thing, please avoid multivitamins because that's chemical. And I would give you three things daily to be taken and two things weekly. And that will be much, much, much better than any multivitamin in this world. Please, first in children, half apple a day with the skin because all the vitamins are present just under the skin. And one teaspoon of honey and half orange for vitamin C. That's okay. Daily. And one piece of walnut, I mentioned earlier, for the zinc. And weekly, one piece of salmon for omega-3. And one piece of steak, freshly made at home, for vitamin B12. And that would be much more than enough.
Okay, well, Dr. Mohammed, we have to let you go now, but it has been a complete education for me. I have really enjoyed this conversation, and I will look at children very differently. I feel like I know how to heal them now. Thank you so much, Dr. Mohammed.
You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation on Dubai i 103.8.
Now, we're going to give you some tips if you're a filmmaker or you're a budding scriptwriter or you want to get into the film industry. I am now joined by local filmmaker and scriptwriter, Maitha Alawadi. She used to be a news intern here at the station and now works with our digital team, but has many, many other talents, and her biggest passion is filmmaking. She recently had one of her scripts selected in the Cannes Film Festival and now is in the middle of making a TV series called Behind the Burqa. And when she told me this, I was like, I need to get you on. So here she is, Maitha. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
How's everything going since we last met? Are you still scribbling away at your scripts?
I am, and I just got back from Santorini, so I'm really sunburned. My nose looks like Rudolph.
Okay, you're not here to make me feel envious or jealous right now. We're here to talk about work, okay? Okay, so let's talk about this. Now, Behind the Burqa, that sounds fascinating. I've read a list of what the cast is like too. We're going to go through that later. How did this series first take off? Like, how did it begin? Because I know it's linked to Image Nation here in Abu Dhabi, right?
Yes. So at first, when the series first came to mind as a film, actually, I was watching What We Do in the Shadows by Taika Waititi, and it just came up, why can't we do something about Dubai and do a mockumentary about it, like about the lives of Dubai citizens? And then I was, last year, I was associated with Image Nation, pitching some ideas to them. One of them was this idea as a film. And one of the people recommended me to this film independent workshop that they're doing abroad, which is AFS, Episodic Storytelling 2021. And I never heard of it before. So I did some research and it looked like a great opportunity because I'll be working with people from the industry in Hollywood. And I thought, why not? Let's just try and apply. And I'm so grateful that I got in. And I just finished my first virtual workshop and I'm starting my next one in the end of August.
So let's go Behind the Burqa. What exactly is it about? Did you write the script?
Yes, I did. So basically, Behind the Burqa started with the idea of what is an Emirati woman and who is she? That's what many people ask me the first time they meet me. She's a mystery to those outside of her sphere of friends and family. And that's what I wanted to unveil. So Behind the Burqa came from that idea. And the series is an ongoing half-hour English comedy drama mockumentary where a documentary crew follows the daily lives of four modern-day Emirati girlfriends in Dubai as they try to figure out who they are while navigating cultural and traditional pitfalls. Basically, it's Modern Family meets Halal Sex in the City.
Do you know
That's
what?
That's how I see it.
I can relate to a lot of these characters because I grew up as an Indian with my culture around me in an English Western in the UK. So I was very confused as well. So I can totally relate to this. Let's go through the characters individually because they seem like fun characters. Firstly, you've got Amna.
Yes. So all of the characters are in their early 20s and we followed them through their journey till they hit 30.
Right.
So we have Amna, who is the idealistic dreamer and an artistic soul. She can come off as gullible, spacey, and she makes daily situations dramatic, but she's awkward with strangers, mainly men. Her mission is to find a husband in any way possible before she hits 30.
Oh my goodness.
That is relatable to a lot of people,
I think, me included. Okay, before we go on to the next characters, are any of these based on you?
Amna is. I was like, Amna was based on me in my 20s, where my main goal was to find a husband because society kind of made us feel that we need to find someone before we hit 25 or 30 because that's how we complete our cycle. Like we finish university, we find a husband, we settle down, we start a family, and we look at our career at the same time.
But you know, I totally relate to that. And you know what, I once was watching Oprah and this priest comes on and he says, it's best to marry the wrong person at the right time than the wrong person at the right time. So we all feel before 30 is a good time, especially for women. But, you know, it's exactly the same for most women. It's tough. So have you found your husband?
No, I haven't, and I'm 31 now, so I'm actually enjoying my life more without one, I would say.
Okay.
But I think at this age, when you hit 30, you actually become more mature, and you know what you want in a person, in a partner, because you're not looking for a husband, you're looking for a life partner.
Absolutely.
And then I think that a lot of women don't understand that they change so much during their 20s that when they hit 30, they actually are more grounded in their career, in their family life, in their personal life. And then they know exactly what they're looking for in a partner. And it narrows it down. Some people call us picky, but we just call ourselves realistic because now we know exactly what we want, what we're looking for. And we don't pull punches in a sense. We just look for that one person.
Yeah, and the person you would have gone for in your 20s is probably the person you won't go for in your 30s because you've changed. So let me go on to the next character, Mariam.
Yes.
What is she like?
The ex-wild child.
Oh, I like this.
I call her the ex-wild child because she's the only housewife of the group, but she used to play the field until she was locked down. And she's reliable but stubborn when it comes to her opinions and principles. Hmm. And now she's just trying to fit in with her conservative, strict new in-laws without losing herself. So I feel like a lot of women went through that phase as well. So that's why I made Mariam to represent them.
Okay, these are great characters. The next one, which I love the name of, Sarah the Arab Barbie, you call her.
Yes, because she is based on the stereotype that people see us on. Mm. So for her, if it's not branded, she's not interested unless it's gossip. She aims to be the number one most loved influencer in the Middle East, and she can come off as narcissistic and dismissive of others, but deep down, she's really loyal and fierce when it comes to her loved ones. And in the journey of the four girls, you will actually see her development that you kind of crack the surface layer of her personality, and then you delve deeper and you see that she's not just a pretty doll. She's actually more intense than that. She offers more to the group than just being pretty and, you know, an influencer in a sense.
And finally, we've got Fatma.
Yes, the only one who comes from mixed parentage. And I think that's a really big topic that we need to discuss as well in the series, because a lot of Emiratis have been married to Westerners and Asians and are like different Middle Eastern backgrounds. So she represents those mixed parentage children who don't know where they fit in. So she comes from an Emirati dad and American mom, which is two different cultures altogether. But she's an independent, career-driven lawyer and is the rational voice of the group, keeping the carrots in line, or in this case, Sarah, while trying to prove that a woman can be successful without a man. And for her, she's very dear to me because I have sisters who are kind of like her. They're half Jordanian, half Emirati.
Yeah.
And I remember the oldest one, she's 17 now. when she was younger, she didn't know where she fit in. She was more with her Emirati heritage, but people perceived her as Jordanian because of her last name. And she always used to struggle between that identity crisis, in a sense. Now she's more grounded because, you know, she has her family support. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, I think, have gone through this where they don't know where they fit in. Do they fit in with their parents, with their mother's background or their father's background?
Totally. I mean,
and I think it's...
Yeah, go ahead.
And I think that parents need to allow them to blend those two cultures together and teach them both cultures to be able to fall in love with both and make it something of their own rather than trying to fit in with a specific culture.
Yeah.
That's basically my personal opinion for that.
Because one of my very close friends, her mom is from Finland, her dad is from Lebanon, and she always felt that, even though she lived in Lebanon for a while and lives here, she's always felt like, where do I actually fit in? Because she'd have blonde hair, stand out, not look totally Arab, but she is half Lebanese. So yeah, I think it's a big adjustment and trying to make the child feel to understand both cultures, because as a child, you just want to fit in. That's all you want to do when you're younger.
Exactly. And Fatima also represents those women that do not want to settle down, that want to focus on their career and become an independent woman that they can be proud of. And they don't want to bow down to the norm of society where a woman is meant to settle down and have a career at the same time. She just wants to be a career woman, and that's fine. And I think that she presents that. And the funny thing with Fatima is her mom, her American mom, is actually a matchmaker. And her brother is a tragic Romeo. So she has those people with those, you know, relationship factors that are pushing it on her all the time through either stories of her brother's escapades or her mother's matchmaking skills, who is trying to find the perfect match for her daughter. So she's being pulled on those two sides, but she just wants to establish herself as a career woman. And that's the beauty about Fatima, I think. What doesn't kill you
makes you stronger. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Well, I'm talking to filmmaker Maitha Al-Awadhi. We've just been through some of the fun characters that she's creating for a new series called Behind the Burqa. Where is this going to eventually be shown? Because you're working, you said, with somebody in Hollywood on this, right?
Yeah, so we're workshopping our first pilot and Bible, and then we're going to pitch it to networks. I'm hoping to really get this one on Netflix because I think that platform kind of goes worldwide and is the best platform for this series. But I might also look at HBO or anyone else that might be interested, honestly.
Well,
but ideally, it's Netflix.
So, okay, let's just say that somebody says, yes, we're going to put this on. Would it be filmed, I'm assuming, in Dubai, right?
Yes, it will be filmed in Dubai with an all Emirati cast, honestly, because I think that I want to give a voice to Emirati women and Emirati culture, and the best people to represent them are people from this culture. So if it's it will definitely be filmed in Dubai, and the cast will definitely be locals or people from the UAE generally.
Okay. Is there any, you've explained the characters, a little bit wild, a little bit crazy, like we all are in our 20s. Are you worried about some of the things you can bring up? Is anything off limits, or are you going to be quite honest and open about this?
There are some limitations to what I can put on air. And in the end, it is a cultural film. It is about educating people about our culture. That's why I made it English, because I want to bridge the gap between the West and the East. And so I don't want to portray my culture in a bad set way. And there are some things I will never put on the series, like things that showcase our culture in a bad light. However, I will be very open and honest about the topics that girls will go through. And it's typical topics that any Emirati girl will go through in her life. And I think one of the most controversial ones would be the finding the husband way, because when I said any way possible, I meant every way possible. but other than that, it just touches upon the topics of what Emirati girls go through in terms of what society expects from them and what they want for themselves, what their families expect from them, and the balance that these girls go through, make of those two expectations. But the things that there are some things specifically I will never put in, which is like things that are brought in from the West, in a sense, kind of like, the club scene, or, you know, those type of things that showcase it, the culture in not realistic tone, because we're not really that type of culture. We're not really into the club scene. We're not really into that scandal scene that much. We're very conservative in a sense. Mm-hmm. And I want to keep that away from the girls, in a sense, because we have already TV series in the Kuwaiti market, in the Emirati market, in Arabic already that covers those,
okay,
the clubs and the alcohol, the family drama and the betrayal and all that. And I don't want that to touch upon the girl because you don't represent them. They don't represent that. They have their own goals.
So what are some of the misconceptions that you've personally come across being an Emirati woman that you want to share in this show to break those misconceptions?
Some of the misconceptions that I've had is, do Emirati girls always wear the abaya and shirah? No, they don't.
You don't.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of people are not wearing it in some areas as well. Like when they travel, they don't wear it. Are you too conservative? Are you like you're not allowed to talk to anyone outside of your culture? No, we mingle with other people. We mingle with other cultures. Do we speak proper English? Or you lived abroad. That's another misconception. You lived abroad, really? So do you have to get married? Why aren't you married? You have to have kids. There's a lot of small misconceptions, but I think a lot of people have opened up to the Emirati culture, or the Emirati culture have opened up to the world. And those misconceptions have been put aside in the last 5 years, I would say.
Mm.
But there's misconceptions about families.
Yeah.
About I still get some people fearing to be associated with Emirati women because they think that their fathers or their brothers will run after them. So it was like, no, that's not how it goes. Or they're worried about what they can and cannot say in front of an Emirati woman specifically because Emirati women are seen as untouched and unapproachable for some reason. And I think it's because of the way we handle ourselves because when we walk in the, I don't know, I think the way they see us is like, I want to say that they might look at us like I would love to say that they look at us Cate Blanchett, like you know the gliding on the red carpet, you cannot touch it in a sense. but that's my wishful thinking. I'm hoping that that's how they see us. I just want to showcase that we are similar to every other woman in the world. We're the only thing that differentiates us from them is that abaya and shirah and our different culture, and that is it. Other than that, we are similar to every woman. We have similar problems. We have similar struggles. We have similar goals. And that's what I essentially want to showcase to the world.
And briefly, as an Emirati woman and a woman just generally, what advice would you give to other females out there, you know, who want to move into the film industry? Any top tips?
I would just say start writing and start producing. There's never a good time to enter the film world, and that there's never a time that it's too late for you to enter the film world. You can make something big in your 20s, or you can make something big in your 40s. There's no expiration date. But the most important thing is to just do it. Do it with a passion. Do it with the love you have for the film industry. And don't worry about how it will be perceived. Because in the end, it's your vision, your passion that you're selling to the world. It's not the content itself sometimes.
Okay.
I actually was told by the creator of Paranormal, we had a workshop with him and Amr Salama, and he told me one thing, when you're pitching ideas to people, you're not pitching the story fully. You're not pitching the idea itself. You're pitching the passion, your passion for the idea and why you're the best person to tell that story.
Okay. Well, I was going to say thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have to go to the news now, but thank you so much, my love. And I wish you all the best. And you need to tell me when this gets, if it gets done by, you know, bought by Netflix or whatever, please let me know.
I will. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. All the best, my love.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Well, I just had one female filmmaker on. I now have another one who's a friend of mine by the name of Sophia DeMay. She's actually directed me in a TV show previously when I first came to Dubai. Before we chat to her, I want to talk about a few stats when it comes to women in film. Now, the percentage of women overall working as directors, writers, producers, executive producers, cinematographers was only 34% between 2019 and 2020. And film festivals during that time as well selected or screened an average of 12 films directed by men compared to an average of 6 films directed by at least one woman. But I do have Sophia with me now, and she's one woman who's cracked it into the film industry and has had a successful 20-year career. She's directed feature-length films, documentaries, commercials, wildlife series. She even directed me on my TV show Out and About. She's won hundreds of awards, including the Cannes Film Festival and the New York Film Festival, and she's joining me now. Hi, Sophia.
Hi, Poonam.
How are you? I'm doing good. Tell everybody, how hard was it to direct me on TV? You can be honest.
You were amazing. you looked fantastic. You were so full of great ideas.
But did I listen to you?
You did, but you offered other ideas as well. You were like full of sort of creative thoughts and yeah, you were super.
Well, do you know what? That's really interesting what you've just said, because, you know, when I've had male crew or producer or director, when I've offered great ideas, which you just said, they would say, oh, she's being bossy. Did you get that a lot in the industry, working around a lot of men? Because as a director, you are, you know, you're pretty much the boss on the set.
Yeah, I'm meant to be the boss, but that's never, ever sort of been my style. Not a very bossy person, slightly shyer. So usually I have an AD for that, and they can do all the bossing.
That's an assistant director.
Yeah, they can issue all the orders and scream at everyone and get them in line and herd sheep, whatever they have to do. I like to reflect and sort of make those judgment calls and not be sort of too worried about what the rest of the crew are doing. And usually with very professional crews, everyone is very disciplined. Everyone knows exactly what they're meant to be doing. And they're highly efficient and, you know, and they give of their best. You know, we've had briefs before. So, I tend to sort of sit there and be a little bit quieter in my approach. I'm not great at being bossy.
Well, tell people what are some of the big projects that you've worked on so that they understand where you come from?
The bigger projects, I've recently been working for National Geographic. I've been doing a series on their space program, which was the astronauts on Mars for satellites. That's been a fantastic experience. I've done a feature film documentary, which was a very long project. I've written a feature film, a drama, which was actually made into a feature film. I didn't direct that. I've done many television series, working for Discovery, National Geographic, CCTV, a bit of Dubai One, Abu Dhabi TV.
So the list goes on. And you've won loads and loads of awards. Now, you grew up in South Africa. When you first started, were there a lot of female directors there? Like, how did you actually get into the industry in the first place? Did you know it's something you always wanted to do?
Firstly, no, it wasn't something I always wanted to do. I actually began as a journalist, and I was sort of more interested in, I felt very comfortable with words and writing. And then I was sort of working as a copywriter and a creative, and I slowly sort of segued into script writing. And then what would happen is I'd sit in edits with other directors, and, you know, I'd help them put voiceovers down to the script and change scripts and edits while they were doing post-production. And then I'd come on set quite a lot and help with presenters and do, you know, and so I watched a lot of other directors. And then I remember feeling like seeing a lot of the work, the end products, and thinking that wasn't exactly what I had in mind. I visualized it slightly differently. And then sort of feeling like I wish I could try this. And then a female producer actually believed in me and gave me a break, and she was great, and we began. It was a very wacky, edgy, off the wall, crazy television series for children, all shot all over Africa. And I sort of hit the road running and learnt on the job, and she held my hand and got me through all the sort of difficult moments where I wouldn't have known what I was doing. That's how it began.
Well, I think you're right there, because I think there's no straight road with the media industry. And like for me, I learned on the job, and then I ended up, as well as becoming a presenter in front of the camera, I then became a videographer and an editor and producer or whatever. But I do remember you were the first person I worked with on TV as a director, and your eye was so good. So I was actually learning a lot from you without you even knowing that, you know. So it's so good when you surround yourself. You do learn on the job. You can train as much as you want at your college or film school. But, you know, what tips would you give to people who do want to get in the film industry right now? Because the landscape's changed a lot because of COVID as well, don't you think?
Yeah, look, COVID has affected it. But, I mean, any tips for people wanting to get into the industry, I would say, you know, obviously just do it. Be courageous. Take opportunities. Work out where your strengths are. Work with people who believe in you as well, who don't undermine you. I think that's very, very important. People who inspire you. You know, there's nothing better than working with a passionate crew, all having fun. And it's not like people trying to sort of, you know, question your judgment calls, undermine you, because, you know, there's a lot of insecurity when you're on set and you're directing someone and you look at it and you're thinking, is this right, is this wrong? So you need to be with people who are strong around you, and you respect their judgment and their vision as well, and they respect yours. And I think just go for it, and take every opportunity to learn, and you know, and be inspired.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer,
only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Well, I have a lovely friend of mine who's directed me on TV as well. She's a director in films, documentaries, you name it, with children, adults, all kinds of things. Sophia DeFay is with me. Now, Sophia, what was it like when you were starting? Were there female directors around you? And how do you think it's evolved? Or do you think there's still a long way to go when it comes to women working behind the scenes in the film industry?
Well, first question, when I began, there weren't a lot of female directors. I can't even remember who they were at the time. There was one, actually. She was a photographer who'd actually sort of moved into becoming a director. But it was very limited at that time. There weren't a lot. And since then, I mean, I see a lot of female directors, and there are many, but I don't think there are enough.
I agree.
And I think that it's still very biased, and the numbers are small, and you know, they don't have a big enough voice. They're not sort of getting the opportunities. I don't think there's enough of us, actually.
But do you think that is because it's quite male dominated at the top?
Well, they say that. I mean, when you read the stats and you read about it, they say all the gatekeepers and that are like mainly male producers, and they'll favor the bias, the systemic bias will be towards men. I don't know what the reason is. You know, we work so hard and we have a different approach, and, you know, in terms of sensitivity and aesthetic sensibility. And I think that we've got so much to give. And, you know, our window to this world, and I think it really should be appreciated, and I hope that we get more opportunities.
What are some of the hardships that you've encountered being a woman in that industry that you've seen male directors probably not faced on a personal level?
Crew sort of undermining you a little bit. you know, in the beginning it was quite hard to manage, sort of, because when I was first directing, what used to happen is that the DOPs, cameramen, would actually become directors. That was sort of, I came in from writing, from a different background. So I didn't have that much on-set experience. And they didn't like that I hadn't been through that whole school of sort of work my way up from being a peer runner through, you know, all the different focus puller. So these DOPs and that felt that I hadn't sort of earned my stripes, really. And I just walked into this job. So I felt that there would be a lot of questions. Like they'd be cocky and cheeky with me, and they wouldn't always, you know, listen. So I had to, you know, like, you know, always sort of question my own judgment. If I said, that's a beautiful shot, they'd go, is it, you know?
but would that make you doubt yourself? Or were you always quite, did. You didn't have that strong passion that, no, I know this is right. They're just having an issue with them, with me, but it's fine. It did make you doubt yourself.
Well, I mean, I had to sort of get them to do what I wanted. So I sort of like used to say, okay, let's do it my way and then we'll do it your way. And then we'll decide what's best, you know. There was a lot of rebellion. I felt that it wasn't that easy just to come in there and basically was also starting to, at that point, to find crews and find the people who did support you. That's what I'm saying. It's so important. And often the very, very good, talented people were more difficult, more challenging personality types, and they weren't going to make it that easy. And a lot of them wanted to be director. So, you know, everyone wants to be the director, would appear.
Yeah.
And so there's always that sort of, you know, sort of questioning. And I think that, as you said in the beginning, are you a bossy person? I think that that's why directors are often very, very strong personalities, and they dictate and they say, right, you know, they'll, you know, completely extinguish any insubordination or rebellion. My mistake was maybe I didn't. And I sort of would sort of look around and think, well, maybe, you know, but at the same time, I just pursued and carried on with my particular vision, whatever I was doing. I did believe in what I was doing. So I'd sort of basically get what I wanted at the end of the day, which you have to do as a director.
So apart from my working with me and my TV show, what's been your all time favorite project to work on ever? If you had to choose one.
Oh God, there were so many. I've had the most crazy experiences. I mean, you know, being a director, you live the most extraordinary life. You know, I've been in war zones. I've been in Nepal earthquake. I've been in tsunamis. We worked in Somalia during the famine. I've witnessed the most incredible events and been part of them and touched people's lives in extraordinary ways and been, you know, witness to the most incredible things. And I think that being a director just gives people the most amazing, you know, opportunity to meet people in power, meet, you know, the most ordinary people who are living extraordinary lives. And, you know, you're continuously learning and absorbing and, you know, it's a privilege. And I remember one producer once saying to me, this life is a privilege, you know, and it has been. So I think that's...
And what can we see in the future? What's in the pipeline? Anything that we can look forward to from you?
Well, we're working on Expo, and so with Reem Alhouni and TR22 Films, we've got a lot to do on the Expo.
Yeah.
And we've got a lot of projects that we are actually wanting to develop for Netflix and drama series, things like that, that I'm always constantly working on and thinking up new ideas and you know, possibilities. You know, I think that's the other thing. We're continuously creating new opportunities, which is another thing I'd say to all other directors, that you've got to keep sort of looking for gaps and ideas and, yeah.
Okay, well, Sophia, I know Sophia very well, and her brain is ticking 120% all the time, 24 hours a day. So as a creative person, she's always got something going on. Sophia, thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Poonam, thank you so much. It's been fantastic chatting to you, and thank you.
And you'll have to direct me again soon, okay?
Catch up soon. Thank you.
Also, Elisa sent a really good question. I didn't want to end on this, but I will mention it. She said, did you get paid less than your male counterparts? I'm sure Sophia has a lot to say with that. We'd need another half an hour for that.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
On Dubai Eye, 103.8.
Poonam Verma with you. I can't even say my surname these days. I don't know what is going on. And anyway, so Poonam Verma with you all week from 2 to 5 this week. We're talking about a topic that I'm so passionate about, which is holistic health. And I was really happy when I heard that the Dubai Health Authority recently announced that mental health and alternative medicine treatments such as Ayurveda and homeopathy will now be covered under basic health insurance plans in Dubai. Now, I've used alternative therapies my whole life. I'm a massive advocate of them. If you follow me on Instagram, I interview a lot of people in the wellness space. And one that has helped me with a variety of personal real-life issues has been homeopathy. It's a 200-year-old form of alternative medicine that stimulates a healing response and strengthens the body's ability to heal itself. Now, right now, I have my very own personal homeopath doctor joining me in Dubai, Dr. Javed Hingora from the Dubai Homeopath Health Center. How are you, Doc?
Hello, hello. All good. Very well. Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
I know. Long time no see. I think I've been pretty healthy. That's why I haven't seen you for a while. And you've been treating me. He's been treating me on and off for 12 years, and he's done an amazing, amazing job. Now, first of all, tell everybody, that those who don't know, because a lot of people don't know about alternative therapies. In simple terms, what exactly is homeopath? How is it prepared? What is it made from?
Right. So the first thing is that it is called an alternative, and it is a wrong way of addressing it. And this is where the word alternative comes from mainstream medical pharmaceutical companies and the medical sciences, where anything which is non-chemical is blocked or classified as alternative.
Okay.
Although all the alternative medical systems, they depend completely on our own natural healing ability. So it is our frontline defense, is the most important energy or the ability that we have to survive is our own natural ability to fight off infections, to heal ourselves, our bodies. So that should not be called alternative in the first place.
Sorry, Doc.
Now, the world is gradually moving towards accepting that the so-called alternatives have an important role to play in the current medical establishment, because a lot of conditions frustrate people who have to be on medication to manage their health conditions. They have to endlessly take pills and treatments, go from one specialist to another, and they still don't find real balance and real happiness. They might find relief and effective management. I'm not saying it's not effective, but when you talk about really good health in a natural way without the crutch of medication, that's called real healing. And that is the difference between a regular medical evaluation and a holistic natural evaluation. I won't call it alternative anymore.
Let's call it holistic, yeah?
Yes,
okay.
Let's call it holistic.
So I thought I got told off then by my doctor. So live on air. So listen, what you've just basically said is homeopathy, it heals the core of the issue, whereas, you know, a lot of tablets that you get from the doctors are treating the surface symptom. And I'm going to give you, I've had many real life experiences with homeopath, which is why I'm a big advocate for it. So I had sinus problems when I was about 13, 14, which means, you know, you wake up and your nose is always stuffy. And people would say, you need to have an operation, clear your sinus systems, or you need to detox. And then my mom took me to a very old homeopath doctor who's passed away now. And he explained how the sinuses are all through the body. And he asked me the most bizarre questions that no doctor would ask you. You know what I'm talking about, Dr. Javed.
Yeah.
Yeah, such as, you know, what side do you sleep on? Do you like cold food? Do you like hot food? Oh, what makes you angry on a personal level? And I'm like, how is this going to unblock my sinuses? And from these questions, he gave me a tablet. And I can tell you, I have never I was on them for 3 months. I've never had sinus problems to this day. And I won't tell you how many years ago that was, but it was a long time ago. So, you know, the questions, you ask questions before you give any diagnosis that a normal doctor wouldn't ask. I'm guessing, is it because they are emotionally related, a lot of the issues that we have?
Well, to really explain it properly might take an hour or so, but to make it really short and precise so that people can understand the basics, homeopathy doesn't treat problems. Your body does.
Okay.
Homeopathy is just a messaging system. It is not a medical system or medicine system. Well, it is a medical science, but it doesn't use medicine in the conventional sense of a physical substance composed of some chemical formula. It is energy messages. The energy is in the form of tiny pills. And that's what misleads people to think that this is medicine. That is why all homeopathy pills look the same white round pills. they don't have different colors, different sizes. Well, some of them have slightly different sizes, but they're all sugar pills. The medicine part is actually the energy part, which is the liquid which is dropped into these pills. All these different various energy messages come from different sources or different origins. It can be a plant extract, it can be a mineral, but all of them are extremely diluted to the point that there is no actual original substance present in them in the physical form. It is all energy form.
Okay.
So now once this idea of energy is clear in people's heads that, okay, this is just energy message. It is not a medicine. We are messaging the body somehow. It's almost like me sending you a WhatsApp message.
Mm.
Does not make your phone heavier. But the message is transmitted.
Okay.
So it's weightless, but something changes in your phone. It conveys a certain message to your phone, and you know it's coming from me. And what if I send you a message in Swahili or Japanese, which you don't understand?
I might do. You don't know that. But go
ahead. Oh, yeah, you might. But what if I send you deliberately in a language which you don't understand?
Yeah.
So you would simply not be able to read it, decode it, or follow the instruction or the message I sent you in a so-called wrong language. Wrong for you. You don't understand that language. That's why you cannot follow the instructions or the message I sent you. But what if I send you a message in a language you understand? You would immediately respond. See, when I say respond, is that's what the body does. It responds to a healing message.
You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation on Dubai i103.8.
So we're talking about homeopath remedies, something I've used most of my life. I'm joined by my own homeopath doctor here in Dubai, Dr. Javed Hingora. Doctor, now we want to talk about some of the things that a homeopath actually treats. On a personal level, I've come to you where you've reduce my cholesterol. I've come to you where two doctors said I needed an operation on my ankle and you treated it with homeopath and the inflammation went down. Mm. You also treated me when I was a very low point in my life. I was struggling for the first time in my life with depression, never experienced that. And you helped me get off those tablets and balance my emotions. So there's a whole array of conditions it can treat. Can you explain some of the things that it does help with that people would never think of coming to you about?
Right. So the most important thing to understand here, again, is that your body heals things. The body heals itself. Homeopathy is just a method to stimulate that healing response from the body. It is a gentle messaging system. So if I send you a message, Poonam, and I tell you, can you lift 200 kilograms, please, with only your right hand?
The answer would be no.
No, you can't, right? No matter how much I message you repeatedly to lift 200 kilograms, it's beyond your capacity. So that's where this messaging system cannot help. What can it not help? Is whatever the body is unable to do on its own. It's physically impossible for the body to reverse or to change. And these are the cases which rightfully belong to the surgical intervention sphere and whatever definitely need surgery cannot be helped. It's if someone has a heart attack, for example, and needs immediate surgery, we can't be sitting and asking questions like, what do you prefer to eat? We have to go for an emergency surgery or whatever. So cases which are real emergency belong to surgery or emergency medicine. Everything else, which is about 80%, the body is capable of healing, reversing, fixing, and that is where this stimulation can help.
So give me an example of quite an extreme case where you've really seen a miraculous change, whether it's been an emotional change, a physical change.
It's hard to come up with a story now, but there have been cases which seem like really impossible to manage or handle because it's a crisis situation, like a child which is really throwing a tantrum or a hyperactive child or a depressed person who's really in deep depression. And I've seen changes within a couple of days, which normally would take weeks, with extensive therapy and medications, even chemical medications, take a lot of weeks to start working. But the body has this incredible capacity or ability to make quick changes way quicker than chemical medicines can, so in many cases.
Are there side effects to homeopath?
Well, since the homeopathic remedies are only a messaging system, there is no side effect. Whatever changes you see is because the body is making the changes willingly. Since you're not imposing anything on the body chemically, there are no side effects as such. I send you a very wrong or offensive message, I might face side effects like slaps and kicks and punches on my face.
Yes, you will.
Yeah, sure. So messaging, it has to be the appropriate, correct message sent to the body so that it can respond appropriately.
Okay, but we're talking about responding. Not everybody will respond to, let's say, homeopath. Is there a reason for that? Is it because it doesn't resonate with them? It's not going to help or heal that particular issue, or they're not open to it?
It doesn't matter if someone believes in it or is open to it or not. It will have a response. The degree of response varies from person to person, depending on their ability to heal. The body's ability to heal differs from person to person. Not everybody has the same healability, as we call it, healability. Is one person as healable as another, having the same sinus issue, for example? No. The response would be totally different.
So I've just had a text from Elisa saying, why does homeopathy then get the reputation of being a psychosomatic placebo?
Well, it's not just homeopathy that has this reputation. In conventional medicine, the mind and the body have been separated as two different disciplines. Like if for mental and emotional issues, you go to a psychiatrist, and for physical issues, you go to a whatever specialist you need to see. Although in a majority of cases, these two are inseparable. I can show you many cases where a person has acidity because they're annoyed or angry from their partner, for example. So should they go to a psychiatrist for their acidity, or should they tell about their annoyance to the gastroenterologist?
Yeah. I really believe this. I just want to know your opinion. Do you think at least one alternative therapy should be part of every medical student's curriculum from now on?
Again, I would say not alternative, but
holistic.
The basics of natural healing and holistic healing.
Yeah.
The processes through which our body heals itself should be an essential subject in medical schools. And it is such a powerhouse. It is such a source of healing, which is ignored, largely ignored, underutilized, sadly not utilized by a conventional medical system. When you have such an amazing body, which is designed so beautifully and has amazing healing powers on its own, why not use it?
Well,
this is my question.
Well, Dr. Javid, I just want to say thank you so much. I know we could talk for ages, but I need to go to the news shortly.
Thank you.
I think I need to pay another visit to you. I'm sure I have a few problems that you can sort me out with.
Sure, anytime.
Thank you so much, Dr. Javid. Thank you for your text as well, Elisa.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Welcome to Afternoons with Helen Farmer, with me, Poonam Verma, with you all week from 2 to 5pm while Helen takes a well-earned break. We are going to be talking now about Masterbrain. Now, with the current situation of living and working through a pandemic, many of us have no choice but to work and study online. And according to Forbes, the e-learning market is expected to grow $325 billion by 2025. And I am now joined by Raju Bulchand, who is the director of Masterbrain, which is a children's learning center, an education center. So tell me, Raju, how are you, first of all?
Good afternoon. I'm fine. Very happy to be with you today.
So tell everybody I know what Masterbrain is. Tell everybody what happens there, why it was created, why the kids go there. Because it's not a normal school. They go after school, am I correct?
Correct. There's a big demand for after-school education, which is just supplementing the children and helping them improve and gather most of their potential.
Okay, so how do you actually do that?
So we have a variety of courses. Our flagship course is the Abacus, which is under the Brain or Brain franchise. And this helps children with their concentration, memory power, and all around improve their student life, makes them better at school.
So give me some experience of what you do there that maybe they won't learn at school. You know, some exercise, some tips that some of the kids and parents listening now can learn.
So right now, when you're doing the Abacus, you're always memorizing. So we have kids who can add and subtract much faster than others. And they can do it not only with speed, but with accuracy. And this is not about adding or subtracting. It's about how they can concentrate to listen to all the data. And it will help them with all their subjects because their concentration power is improving.
So what about age-wise? I mean, how old do you have to be to attend Master Brain?
So we start at the age of 6. That's our KHC license. We're KHC approved. And we go up to 18. But this course particularly is aimed at the 6 to 12 market.
Okay. So let's talk about hybrid education. I think most of us are living a hybrid life just generally. Can you explain first to those who don't know what hybrid education means?
Well, if you know, we all heard about hybrid cars that use petrol and electricity.
That's the first time I ever heard a hybrid word, yeah.
Exactly. So hybrid education is combining both. You're studying at home via the internet on your devices, and you're also going to school. So you're getting the best of both.
Okay, so let's break this down, right? I mean, we didn't have that growing up, so it's very hard for us to compare it. We are now working a lot online as we've got older as adults. What do you think, how do you think hybrid education, first of all, is affecting children?
So, the biggest drawback people find is maybe isolation, but that's not there to be because we have alternative ways of meeting. They can meet their friends in different ways. But when it comes to actual classroom, I think it's improving their experience because they're all in the first row. They're all looking at the teacher straight at the eye.
Mm.
And that gives them a one-to-one education.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it improves, they can concentrate much more. There's no diversions. Looking out the window, walking to the classroom. It's a one-hour session, one-on-one almost.
Okay, so do you see schools and parents in the UAE? I mean, we've had to go online because of COVID right now. Do you see this staying for the future right now? Or do you think once the pandemic eases off, fingers crossed, that we will go back to normal social, one-to-one kids in the class? Or do you think this has completely changed the landscape for education in a better way?
Well, you're using the word normal, and I'd like to say, what is normal? Normal changes with time.
Yeah.
Normal changes with time. So, I mean, our parents never used a computer in the classroom. Now everybody uses devices. There's no textbooks. So what COVID did, what the pandemic did, was accelerated this process.
Mm.
Everything was going to go hybrid. Some courses would be fully online. All we've had an acceleration of the process, which is not a drawback.
It's not a drawback. But you say that. What about, let's talk about, for example, social skills for kids. I mean, you learn so much at school, being on a computer online and just chatting to your friends and seeing them 30% of the time. What happens there?
So, I mean, most of adults, we go to work and then we meet our friends outside work time, right?
Yeah, but the kids, it's in the playground, it's at school.
So we're going to have more of this hybrid and more sort of online learning as they become older. I do agree the younger ages should have more on-site interaction. And by the time they get to high school, 15, 16, they already got their network of friends made, their acquaintances made, and they can meet them other time. But the education can be online.
Okay. So what about teachers? I mean, has it made it easier for teachers or not? I don't know, because I know a lot of teachers, it's been full on for them online.
It's been very difficult, but my teachers adapted in 24 hours. They had to just go. KHCA told us you're shut from tomorrow.
Mm.
And they had to learn. So yes, it's much tougher. But like everything, it will take some development courses, development training for the teachers, and they will adapt. They will adapt like they adapted to electronic boardrooms from the chalk, you know, from the chalk and eraser.
Yeah.
So everything will be an adaptation. They will require training, but it will be available for them.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So we have Raju from Masterbrain. He's the director on the call. And we've been chatting about hybrid education. Most of us are living a hybrid life right now, half at home, half online. One question that people do talk about, parents, what do you think about this, Raju, is if a lot of it is now online, shouldn't the school fees go down?
Yes, totally agree. That's the major concern. But that will happen in the long term because schools have already invested in infrastructure. So the assets are already invested on. Only when it's proven method and in the long term they realize they require less footage can the effect on the fees be seen. Because a major cost is actually the fixed asset, the actual property.
Okay. Now, your team were prepared within 24 hours to go online when COVID hit, right? A lot of schools weren't. Are you seeing a very fast development and technology evolving much quicker over the past year to meet up towards catering for students online?
Yes, definitely. If you see, just the platforms you use are changing almost on a monthly basis, offering more facilities, offering different ways of interact.
So let's talk about exams. I mean, when I grew up, obviously, we had exams. We went and sat them. So my nephew right now, he's in England, and his exams are being, you know, obviously they've changed. It's according to, you know, how his exams reports have been, or he's studying over the past year. He doesn't have to sit proper exams. What do you think of that? Part of me feels that's kind of fair in many ways, because sitting an exam really depends on what mood you're in and how you're feeling. It's so nerve-wracking.
So let me just give you an example of a lawyer. Does he need to memorize all the laws? I mean, my first course in business law was an open book exam. It's taking the data and how you use it.
Yeah.
So you can still do an exam online. It's not about, you know, people are scared, can they cheat online?
Yes, you can. You're right.
But you can do an open book exam. It's about copying what's in the book. It's about how you interpret it and what are your answers based on the facts.
Okay. So the students are very easy to adapt. I mean, kids usually are. And it's kind of normal to so many of them. But what about, parents? How have they adapted to this? What is the feedback that you've got? Has it been quite tiring for them? Because a lot of them had to sit with their kids, monitor them, and also do their own work online from home.
Sorry, you just said they have to sit with their kids?
I did, I did hear that at the beginning.
So when they were dropping the kids to school, they were not entering the class. So when you're doing online, let the kids sit in the room on their own. You don't need to be with them. When they were in the classroom, you're not with them. At the beginning, the adjustment of the
Raju, one second. Your connection is a little bit weak. We're just going to change you. One second. Let's see if this is better. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
Perfect. Yeah, that's great. It's okay. It was cutting out. We just wanted to hear. Sorry, say that again. It was cutting out. Go ahead.
So when you drop your children in school, you don't enter the classroom. So why should you be in the room that the child is doing online education?
But at the beginning, I think I know a lot of parents were. I know that for a fact. I don't know, maybe it's because it was brand new and they thought they might have to sit with them, especially the younger kids.
Okay, the younger ones maybe need some help with the technology, but they'll learn. I've seen two-year-old kids flicking with their fingers on an iPad. So they will learn, but you don't need to be there because it's the relationship with the teacher and the student. If the parent is there, the students will act differently.
Have you come across any children who haven't been suited to online and they're not warming to it, or they're not performing well because of it?
So I think they're not performing well. No, they're not adjusting rapidly enough, but they will given time.
Yeah.
And if there is a special case that can't, there will be. That's why it's hybrid. So they will have classrooms where they can go to.
So have some parents, have they expressed any concerns, worrying that their children may fall behind because they're not at school? Or do you think people are adapting a lot quicker now? It's been over a year now.
I think they're more than adapted.
Do you think the kids will want to go back to school? This is the question, like full time?
Um, Some of them are quite happy at home, but that's a mistake. They shouldn't be comfortable. They should have a routine.
Yeah.
They should be focused. They should be sitting upright. They're not on holiday. They're at home.
But you say that. I mean, even for us as adults, when I'm at home, sometimes I have to get out and go to a cafe to work because I'm like, oh, the TV's there. Oh, the sofa's there. For kids, that's pretty hard discipline.
So try and designate a room where all those distractions are out of the way. Even the desk they're sitting at for a thing should have no clutter on the desk. They should be able to concentrate, no distractions. They are in school. They're at home, but they're still in school online. They need to remember that.
Okay, so I've had a text from Ranjan, and he says, physical school is absolutely critical for children of all ages to develop skills beyond academics only. He doesn't think it should be hybrid. What's your opinion on that?
Well, hybrid is not talking about physical schools disappearing. It's talking about a combination of physical school and online, getting the best of each. Best of each.
So the future, is it hybrid for all of us? Is that what you see, Raju?
So if you look at higher education, say university, people at university are going to have the chance of having the best lecturers because of online. You know, they can have a lecturer from Harvard coming to their university to give a class.
Yeah, I get that. But when I think about my university life, the best thing was the social skills for me more than the education. That sounds so bad, but it is that connection. It's how you grow as a human being. And I create lifelong friends, you know. So it's...
Oh, no, the word was hybrid. On location. They were sitting on location. Some of the classes would be online.
Yeah. Okay then. So Raju, thank you so much for joining us. And that is Raju, the director of Master Brain. We're talking about hybrid education.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Join Helen every week from 2 to 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.